Hi, welcome to Blogging Heads TV. My name is Arya Cohen-Wade, and I'm your host on Culturally Determined today. And I'm very excited about today's guest, who is Matthew Diffie. Matthew, could you introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Matthew Diffie, cartoonist guy.
And most relevantly, you are the author of Hand-Drawn Jokes for Smart, Attractive People, which I'm holding up to the camera right now.
Yeah, it's a limited audience book, but I think probably a lot of your listeners are going to be into it.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that was my first question. Are you limiting yourself with that title?
Definitely. But at the same time, I'm telling people what they're getting. There's that stereotype of New Yorker cartoons that they're all above your head, which is, I'm making fun of that. They're not. There's plenty of poop jokes in this book. For any intellectual level.
So I guess my first question is why, after years of contributing to the New Yorker, why did you decide now was the time to collect your work in a book?
Do a book. Yeah, I've been doing it for the New Yorker for 15 years, and I have, I don't know, it's between 200 and 300 that have been published in the magazine itself. And I figured I needed about 200 for a book. You could do a little thin book, like an airport book kind of thing, but I wanted to have somewhat significant volume. So I guess I just figured I'd hit that critical mass. And of course, those 200 or 300 that get in the magazine, are representative of 10 times that many who never got into the magazine, the rejected cartoons. So I've got
Right,
a
and I
bunch
wanted
of
to ask you
cartoons.
about that some more later because you're also the editor of some of the Rejection Collection series
Yep.
of New Yorker cartoons. I wanted to ask you about your artistic style. To me, it's maybe the most realistic of the current crop of New Yorker cartoonists, and it harkens back a little bit towards the old, like, 20s and 30s cartoons that were more realistic. How did your style
Yeah.
evolve, and how do
Well,
you?
I studied to be a real artist. I wanted to be a gallery artist. So, I definitely spent the time learning those skills and getting my chops. And then when I started doing cartoons, which wasn't until I was 29 years old, I looked at the old New Yorker stuff and I saw this beautiful, charcoalish ink wash kind of, really high-end art. Which has made me feel like cartooning would be a place for me because I guess I'm having put in that time as a real artist, I feel a little bit of a snob about it. I want to draw well, I want to, I guess, show off my skills. And also just I don't love the sort of googly-eyed typical cartoon look. It's usually too silly. So yeah, when I sat down to do it, I looked at the old stuff and I looked at what I was already doing as an artist, not as a cartoonist at that point, but just as an artist. And I tried to come up with sort of a marriage between the two. Pretty realistic, but also pretty, a little bit simplified. Like if I was going to sit down and draw a self-portrait or a portrait of you, it would be different than in my cartoons look. But to me, that's sort of part of my comic cartooning voice in a way. Like comedy-wise, I was always drawn to real sort of dry delivery. Or even like English comedy, Monty Python and stuff like that, where they're doing silly, absurd stuff, but something about the English accent and the just the presentation is kind of serious, like mock serious in a way. So I like that place in comedy, and so it makes sense that my drawings are a little more realistic than goofy.
Yeah, I think it provides a great contrast between the, kind of not flat, but the, realistic plain drawing and then the caption, which is,
Yeah.
the
I mean,
whack,
at the
the
same
zany part.
it does sometimes limit me though, I have to say. There are ideas that I think of that I just can't really pull off in my style, like really absurd, silly, like what was happening. At one point I had an idea with a bird sitting on a barbed wire fence saying the caption was something like, a young meadowlark learns the first important lesson of sitting on a barbed wire fence. And so the idea is that the bird had perched on the fence at the worst possible place, so that Yes, I think you understand what I'm saying. He's sitting on the barb. And
Yes.
so the barb needed to be doing like a ooh facial expression. And in my style, that's kind of hard to do like a funny face on a realistic animal. So I found it kind of impossible to draw that. So if there's a cartoonist out there who draws goofy birds, that's your free idea for you. Classy. That's the kind of classy idea, by the way, that this book is full of.
So when you were 29 years old, how did you make the shift from the art you were doing then towards
Yeah.
doing New Yorker cartoons, which is a very strange and kind of high-end and very select style.
Yeah. Well, I was being a real artist, or trying to be, painting landscapes and also doing abstract stuff and, a little bit of everything, which is part of the problem, by the way. I think they want you to do one thing. But I was also studying comedy. I was interested in being a stand-up comedian and writing sketch comedy and all this kind of stuff. So for, a good 10 years, I was really deep into both parts of it, and was even doing stand-up in Boston at that point. And I wasn't, it wasn't, I wasn't wor it wasn't working all the time. Like half the time it would work, and then the other half it would, just depending on how I started usually. But some of the other comedians would come up to me afterwards and say, "Hey, have you ever thought about maybe selling some of those jokes?" Which is kind of a backwards compliment, I guess. So at that point, I kind of knew that I could draw, and I knew that I could write a joke. And then I heard about the New Yorker having a contest, actually, a cartoon contest. Not like the, now they do the caption contest in the back where the drawing is already done and people supply captions. You had to do the whole thing for this. And it was the New Yorker and the Algonquin Hotel co-sponsoring this thing. And so when I saw that, I was like, huh. I'm kind of doing both of those parts. Maybe I'll try this. And growing up, I never wanted to be a cartoonist just because of that other stuff I was talking about. I didn't really want to do like zany Looney Tune kind of stuff. So something clicked, and I said, okay, I'm going to enter this contest. So I, spent about a month, worked up some ideas. I was writing jokes every day anyway. So sort of felt figured out a cartoony style to draw them in and sent them off. And Bob Mankoff, who was the cartoon editor at the New Yorker magazine, was the juror, or the judge, I guess, of the contest. And so it ended up I was one of the three finalists and got to come down to the hotel there, and ended up winning the grand prize, I guess, which was nothing really, just a check for charity, I think, that we got to hand off. But after that point, Bob was the door was open for me to start submitting, so I started sending in cartoons from the New Yorker. Or from Boston down, and came down on some long train rides, and eventually sold one. I actually sold one pretty quick, like in the fifth week of submitting. Sold my first one. I hear a dog.
Yes, the friendly resident dog is
What kind of dog?
upset about something. She's an English setter.
Ah, cool.
Maybe she'll make an appearance, but she's in another room.
How old is she? Is she your dog?
Yep, she will be 8 years old in a
Oh,
couple
okay.
weeks.
That's a good age for a hunting breed, right? They're kind of wild when they're young, right?
Yeah, well, she still acts like a puppy. She still
Oh,
has
really?
that puppyish energy.
Yeah, I want a
And
dog really bad.
there's one
Let's just talk about
particular.
dogs for a half an hour.
We could talk about dogs for a while. There's one cartoon in here that I particularly liked. I'll see if I can find it very quickly. That dealt with dogs. And I'll even hold it up to the
It's
camera.
probably in the pets chapter, yeah.
So holding this up to the camera. And actually, the little sweet dog looks a little bit like the puppy version of my dog, so I like that. I don't know if people can read the caption, but the caption says, "Kennel changes a dog muffin," which is I really like that one.
Oh, thanks.
So the book has sections on kind of general topic areas that New York cartoons often concern, like things that are happening in the offices and
Yeah.
things happening in
Well, that.
doctors' offices and religious stuff, but also some more unusual chapters like lumberjacks and
Yeah.
utensils.
Lumberjacks are funny. That goes back to Monty Python.
Right,
Right?
right, right.
Do you know
Yes, I
Monty
mean,
Python?
how
Yeah.
did you just find that you happen to have a number of cartoons about utensils and lumberjacks and Eskimos, or were these kind of particular comedic interests of yours for a long time?
We did a lot of market research, and the publisher made sure that I put a lot of Eskimo jokes in there. No, when I started to the idea, very early idea of pitching a cartoon book. You know, it's an anachronistic. I don't know what the word. It's an old-fashioned kind of book, and it's a different world now. I don't think they sell very well. I mean, I know they don't sell very well. So,
Well, we're moving copies right now.
yeah, we're going to sell dozens, I hope. So the most cartoon books of the last 10 years have been based on a topic that people are interested in. Like at the New Yorker, they'll do, a book of golf cartoons or doctor cartoons. So the idea is that those kinds of people will want to buy this book, not because they are necessarily fans of cartoons or fans of that cartoonist, but they like golf. So they're going to buy jokes about golf. And that just, I hate the idea of doing that. For one thing, I don't do jokes about golf or enough jokes about golf or enough jokes about any one thing to do a whole book of good cartoons. So this was sort of, I guess what I'm saying is that your cartoon books lately have been marketed to an audience. And so I had that sort of mandate when I was trying to pitch the book because, I'm constantly reminded that nobody cares about me. Just doing a Matt Diffie's greatest cartoons is not a thing that people want. So I sort of tongue in cheek came up with a target audience, and instead of doing golf or cats, I did smart, attractive people, which is already a conceit. And then once we had to figure out what the chapters are, I just thought it would go with it and make it even more absurd and more specific so that there's chapters for smart, attractive pet owners and smart, attractive utensil users. And then it became a challenge to fill those chapters. Like, I already had some jokes about utensils, believe it or not. But I did, dream up some new ideas once that was a chapter. I mean, how do you do 10 or 12 pages on forks and spoons, and in my case, sporks, which I think we all agree are the funniest utensil. But I've got jokes about spatulas, and I don't even remember what else. So it was sort of a back and forth process to come up with the chapter titles, and it's very, to me, I entertained myself, I guess, with coming up with chapters like "Smart, Attractive People in Prison." Just makes me smile a little bit. I don't know why. And the idea that there might be some smart, attractive people in prison that are buying the book. Can they buy books in prison? Maybe they have a cart that they push around, and
Yeah,
I would
borrow from
love
the
it if my
library.
book is on that cart. I don't know. To me, that sometimes you just got to entertain yourself, and that's really what those chapters and honestly the whole book is. What else are you going to do but make yourself laugh and your friends? When you're writing a book like this, that isn't going to be a huge bestseller just because it's a niche thing anyway. When I'm writing and drawing these things, I'm mostly thinking of my college buddies and, friends that really get me. And I'm hoping there's enough people out there that are like me that it's going to do okay and I can do another book.
I have a maybe a cartoon nerd question, but I've always wondered, so pulling up to the screen again, one of your cartoons. So you include a kind of a square, like double border around almost all of your cartoons. Why do you do that, and what's kind of the thought behind that?
Yeah, well, that's because I come from a fine art background where, I was doing paintings, and the paintings always had an edge to the canvas you're working on, and then a frame eventually around that edge. And so for me, that kind of gives a shape to the composition of the piece of art. And now I'm going to sound like a pretentious idiot, but I do think about, how the shapes in the cartoon abstractly are arranged in that square shape. So for me, it had to have a border that the composition can kind of bounce off of and react to. I mean, I do like cartoons that have they just fade to white around, and I did a few of those in this book, just because I've never done them before. But I really like having a concrete edge to the composition. But that clearly comes from me being an artist, whatever, fine artist first.
What's your favorite thing to draw?
Ducks.
I think so. I
Next
think,
question.
well, I think
No,
that
ducks
transitions
are.
into maybe the next thing I wanted to ask about, which is the Diffie Doodles. And I have noticed a lot of animals in that. Can you talk a little bit about
Yeah, well, I am a
this project?
sort of a dinosaur in the sense that I do cartoons in print. And I can't figure out which way to pull my. This is an example of how dinosaur-like I am. I guess I need to move this way. Okay. So I have not been online and you know, about I don't know, about 5 years ago, I realized that I'm putting cartoons out in this magazine and probably people like them. I hope people like them, but I don't know who those people are. And meanwhile, there was these, you know, sort of boom in online comics. And so you had people like Kate Beaton and I don't know, Matthew Inman, the oatmeal guy, who have these huge audiences that they can reach. So I have been trying, you know, in the last 5 years, I guess, to claw my way onto the internet so that I can get some smaller version of that audience that is, you know, self-selected to like what I do and I can reach them. And so the big part of that was to do the newsletter. And so the Diffy Doodles started as a, I don't know, a way to connect to those first subscribers to my newsletter. So I put that out there, and then some friends of mine retweeted it or whatever, and I ended up with 1,500 people signing up for the newsletter, and I had promised to give them a free original little Diffy Doodle, which is just a small, like quarter regular sheet of paper size doodle. And I was excited, but then it became, oh my goodness, I got to draw 1,500 of these. And they took longer than I thought, I guess. Maybe it's just the artist in me or the perfectionist in me. I can't really dash something off and say, oh, that's fine. I end up spending way too much time in it. But it's great because I've got this 1,500 core group. And since then, people who sign up, they get a print of the 100, sort of my 100 favorite doodles, which is also kind of nice because you get one immediately. Because the people on the 1,500, they're still almost half of them are still waiting. It's been a year, so they're very patient about it. But
Yeah, I have
I'm
to
doing
say,
these doodles every
I
day.
am one of those subscribers. I'm still
I'm
anxiously
so sorry.
checking the mail every day,
I'm
waiting for
doodling
my
as
Diffy
fast as I
Doodle.
can. Yeah, I spend about
But
an hour on it.
you also show all your Diffy Doodles on your Twitter feed, which we'll link to, and they are often very entertaining or just an interesting little sketch. Sometimes
Or
kind of
weird, yeah.
right.
It's
Sometimes kind
interesting.
of a half joke or just an
Yeah.
interesting drawing.
It's nice actually to be able to draw and not have to do a joke. That has been very fun for me because usually so much of cartooning is just, you know, grinding out these ideas, you know, unless you have an idea, you can't even start drawing. So the doodles are just pure drawing fun. But they do pile up, and maybe I made it too negative. I love sending these out, and I love seeing people post them and talk about them, and it's a really wonderful, real old school connection. Like you signed up, and I made a drawing, and I mailed it to you. There's something really nice about that. And doing the newsletter, the Diffieville Dispatch, has because of that connection, has a really nice, warm feeling to me. And like I say, the people that sign up now, you'll get a print immediately, and you'll get to choose the one you want. So that's a good thing, I think. But those 1,500 will always be my favorites.
And we'll include
And
links.
someday, wouldn't it be cool? Someday, like 10 years from now, we'll have like a Diffy Doodle meetup, and people from all over the country will come and hold their little doodles. We'll do it at the Louvre.
Yeah, that's a lovely idea. And we'll include links where you can sign up for your newsletter and check out your website. So you mentioned some of the internet cartoonists who have blown up, like the Toast. You know, the internet has been a mixed bag at best for most print media, and has been harmful for a lot of print media. Do you think the internet has been good for cartoonists?
Well, yes and no. I mean, people that are on it, it's great. I mean, except for the fact that you don't make money until you get a big enough audience. And so there's that work you got to do. But you know, with things like Patreon, which I'm hearing a lot about lately, I think there's some web comics that are making really good livings. And like I say, they have a really tight dedicated, engaged audience, which is a wonderful thing. It has definitely hurt some of my contemporaries or my, old, maybe older cronies at the New Yorker who are reluctant to get online. They're like, "What? I'm going to post three cartoons for free?" They don't get the long term picture, and maybe for them it doesn't make sense because a lot of these guys are in their 80s or 70s at least. And then in other cases they just can't do it. They just don't know how to do the technology. I'm kind of in between there where I am always calling friends. Why is it blue? How do I, turn this off? How do I? Yeah, just there's so much stuff that if you don't know what you're doing, you're kind of not doing it effectively. As far as tagging images, I think, and stuff like that, and searchability, and I don't even know what I'm talking about. But I think it's good and bad, I guess. It's bad for some, and it's great for others. If I was starting out as a cartoonist, there's no doubt that I would start a webcomic right now. Even though I think that the gold rush period is over in some senses, but you can still grow a nice audience slowly. And I think like the books, when I was talking about how people want books, cartoons about certain topics, I think that also helps online. If you do a cartoon strip, online strip about video games, you're gonna be successful. Whether you want to do that or not. I think it'd be cooler to find a more niche online audience, because every possible audience is out there, I think.
Why don't we talk a little bit about the rejection collection and what, the kind of the submission process at the New Yorker and what things get taken and then the things that don't get taken. So how, I mean,
Sure.
how does it work when you're pitching the New Yorker?
So yeah, there are about, I don't know, 30 or 50 cartoonists that are somewhat regularly appearing in the magazine, The New Yorker. And we all are supposed to do about 10 ideas a week. So, you'll spend however long you need to do to make 10 ideas that you aren't embarrassed about, which in my case is, several hours a day. I get hundreds of ideas and draw the 10 best ones. And even in those 10, some of them are kind of, "Ooh, that's the best I got." Anyway, you send in those 10 to Bob Mankoff, who's the cartoon editor. In my case, you send them in. If you're in town, and when I was in New York for 12 years, you'd go in on Tuesdays and everybody else would come in, and it was kind of a fun social thing. You'd sit across from Bob and he'd flip through your cartoons. "Oh, how's the weather? How you doing?" And he'd pick two or three to keep and give you back the rest. As I'm sending him in online, I don't really know which ones he likes or which ones he doesn't. It doesn't really matter. I'm just churning out cartoon ideas, not trying not to get too attached. I like to say it's like being a mother sea turtle. You just kind of lay the eggs and waddle back to sea. So then Bob looks through all the ones that he's sort of liked that week from people, and he says he looks at 1,000 cartoons every week, and he's got room for 15 in that week's issue, or a week's issue. So then he takes them to a meeting a couple days later, the best of that batch or those batches, and he shows them to David Remnick, who is the main editor of the magazine. And often there's a third person there just to, I think, help in voting. And I'm not sure who that person is now. Anyway, David Remnick, according to Bob, makes the final decision on which ones they're buying. And if you sold a cartoon, you get an email saying, "Okay, you have this okay." This is interesting. This is how the New Yorker mentality works. So you do this batch of cartoons and you turn them in, and if they like one of them, if one of them is, deemed good enough to be in like the top magazine cartoon outlet in the world, they call it an okay. Not a good or a great, just a you got an okay this week. So if you got an okay, they send you what it is and or tell you which one it is, and then you do the final art and turn that in at your leisure. I have one that I think I sold 8 years ago, and I still haven't done the artwork because it's hard. It involves like a map of the whole city of Manhattan and a guy in a gorilla suit. Anyway, I won't give a joke away, but someday I'm going to turn it in. But unless it's a timely idea, it has to do with something in the news, which they don't do that many of, and I don't do very many at all. But anyway, so that's the deal. So you turn in 10 ideas on a real good week, you'll sell one. So 90% of your stuff gets rejected. And some of it needs to be rejected because it's bad or it's just not right for the New Yorker, or it's too similar to something they've already done. Lots of reasons. But in those piles of rejected cartoons that you get from doing this for a few years, there are lots of great cartoons. And so that was the idea behind the rejection collection, was to gather. I just basically asked all my friends, my colleagues, hey, give me, a stack of the ones that you've always thought were great and they never would buy. And particularly like outrageous ones, ones that were sort of like there's an additional comedy to be had by the fact that you even submitted this. Like it was so wrong for the New Yorker as far as like it being too dirty or lowbrow or whatever. So anyway, that's how those books started. It was just a chance for us to publish the ones that we secretly believed in. And yeah, we've done three volumes of that. And there's great stuff in there and some horrible stuff or stuff that, it's just like really wrong for the New Yorker.
Right.
But,
Do you ever submit something knowing that it has no chance?
oh yeah, all the time. I mean, what are you going to do? Not draw it? I mean, if it cracks you up at your drawing table, I'm always going to draw that one. For one thing, it might just make Bob laugh, which is never a bad thing to remind him that you're funny. And he gets it. He's a cartoonist himself, so he understands that, there's jokes that don't fit the New Yorker, but I think he needs to see that you're funny and you can tone it down a little bit for the New Yorker, and that's probably going to affect his opinion of you in general and his willingness to pitch your stuff to Remnick. But it's a tough game. I mean, a lot of people think that we haven't made at some point, and it never gets easy. It's always, I mean, it doesn't matter who you are. Like Roz Chast is probably the most popular, cartoon in the magazine right now. But she still, complains about the rejection, and she has to go through it. And that's, honestly, that's a good thing. As tough as it is to take sometimes. Of course, you would think that the cartoons would be better, I guess, sometimes, but it's subjective. That is one thing I have found that I thought we could all agree on which ones are the great ones and which ones are not, but even among cartoonists, there's varying opinions. And there's different kinds of cartoons. Some cartoons are trying for a real hard laugh, and some are trying for a little bit more poetry. And The New Yorker has both kinds, or all 12 kinds. I don't know how many kinds there are, but.
Do you have a favorite one that was rejected?
Well, speaking of ducks. There's one I used to always say my favorite was the one with the two ducks on the doorstep, and obviously they've just knocked on the door, I guess, with their beaks. And so a man has opened the door, and one of the ducks sitting there on the doorstep is saying, "Have you ever thought about becoming a duck?" Which has always been one of my favorites. Pretty
And
absurd.
did that one get in, or was that one rejected?
That one was rejected. Oh no, wait. That one got in. You're right. Oh, a favorite rejected one. Okay. My favorite rejected one also involves birds, oddly enough. It's two pigeons way up on like a high ledge on the side of a building. And so you can see the pigeons on the ledge, and then far in the distance you see sort of the street below, and the idea is that pedestrians are walking down there. So anyway, one of the pigeons says to the other pigeon, I'd say my biggest influence is probably Pollock, which is a high-end poop joke. And I love that. I love the fact that you have to know who Jackson Pollock is and be somewhat familiar with his work. And you have to be able to laugh at a joke about dropping poop. That's the perfect audience for me.
I think I have a favorite cartoon of yours that actually I was surprised wasn't in here because there's a section on religion. It's the one where the two seeming missionary guys are at someone's door and they're handing him something, and the guy says, you call this
Call this
literature.
literature. That's true. That one is about religion. All right, well, that's a perfect example. That's like you like that cartoon a lot, and I don't love it. I don't know why. To me, it feels like a word play that I was going to say that doesn't have enough sort of character behind it, but it's clearly a character-based cartoon because the guy is like a probably an English professor, the guy who's saying it to these guys at his door. I don't know. Maybe that's a better cartoon than I realized. That could be my opinion of that cartoon could have a thousand different things going on. Like maybe I thought that week that I sold that cartoon, I actually had a better idea in that batch, and so I'm still subconsciously judging that other one poorly because it wasn't as good as the other one. I don't know. Maybe it's maybe, see that's what's interesting about cartooning. You put them out there, and you think you have favorites, and but you have baggage attached to them, and then other people really respond to others.
Right.
But why do you respond to that one? Are you an English guy? You
Well,
English
I was an
teacher,
English major in
professor?
college. Maybe that's part of
Ah.
it. The drawing itself, even though I'm not looking at it now, I did like, and the expression on the guy's face, I remember. And yeah, I guess, I mean, it's basically just kind of a pun, a pun
Yeah.
joke, but
You call this
I don't know. There's
literature.
something about it always made me chuckle.
It's interesting. I think this is a would be a fascinating thing because the part of the cartoon's value is how I came up with it and whether I think it's, you know, on a level with my other cartoons. But the biggest part of it, I guess this goes with any sort of art that you're putting out into a to an audience, is that the audience brings at least half of the joy to the equation. So, I mean, if you write a song and you love it and the audience doesn't, is that a good song? Or I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know either. There's definitely an alchemy that happens between the artist and the consumer of that art. So you do not do political cartoons, and political cartoons were in the news in this tragic incident earlier in the year with the attack on Charlie Hebdo. Well, to kind of have two questions coming from that. The first would be, why do you think, line drawings still have the ability to provoke such insane reactions of people? And the second would be, have you ever had any kind of backlash to one of your cartoons?
Yeah. You know, you're saying why do they still have the ability to have such crazy reactions? I don't think it's necessarily the medium. I think it's just the crazy reaction is coming from people that, in my mind and most people's minds, are crazy. They would respond to any sort of format of a joke that insults their very specific taste, I would say. What was the other part of the question?
Have you ever done a
Have I
cartoon
done
that
them?
sparked some kind of backlash?
Not nearly to that level, but I did do a cartoon about the Girl Scouts at one point. Another doorstep cartoon. This is interesting. We've talked about like three sort of people knocking on doors kind of cartoons. So it's a couple of Girl Scouts knocking on the door, and somebody's just opened the door, and so they're saying, "Would you like to buy some Girl Scout crack?" Which is not hilarious, I don't think. It was one of those ones in my batch that I thought, oh, that's just inappropriate and ridiculous, and maybe Bob will laugh at it. But the magazine ended up buying it and running it. And so, what is the joke about? The joke is about, I guess, the fact that the Girl Scouts are such a wholesome thing, and then I have them selling like the worst possible thing you could sell, I guess. And so, to me, that contrast is funny. And it would not be funny if I and everyone didn't hold the Girl Scouts in such high esteem. So it's clear that I'm not saying the Girl Scouts are crack dealers. And yet we got letters from Girl Scout, you know, Scoutmasters, do they have those, I guess? That were just outraged that we had brought the Girl Scouts name down. So anyway, but that's an example, I think, less so, but a level of crazy where you're not able to see anything about the topic you care about as funny, and that is a problem. But I mean, the New Yorker does not usually do cartoons that are meant to provoke, and they definitely don't do really specific editorial style newsy cartoons like political cartoons. You can do sort of general political. And I guess in the last 10 years, they probably have done a little bit more specific sometimes, but it's not really our area of expertise. You know, there's editorial cartoonists who are doing that so well. And it's a different kind of working. It's where you're working to try to say a message, deliver a message. And I think it's hard to be comedic when you're trying to do that. And it's also a lot of reading. So I try not to do that. And you know what?
Yeah.
Another thing, if you do that work, it's only funny that week. So when you try to put together a book of your best stuff, like I've done here, you'd have to have like a little disclaimer in the bottom corner. This week, this was going on in the news, and that's why this is funny. And I don't want to do that necessarily. I want to do hopefully stuff that's going to be funny at least as long as I'm alive.
Yeah, I think most editorial cartoons are not very funny. They're trying to
Yeah.
prove a point, and that gets in the way of the humor. Have you ever seen the Onions parody of a editorial cartoon?
No. I
They
can imagine.
have
Go ahead.
this. I'll link to the archive. It's a kind of very right-wing reactionary cartoonist who almost every single cartoon has the Statue of Liberty with a tear rolling down her cheek. It's kind of a weird little section of the Onion that I almost never see getting passed around, but it is kind of a good satire on
Yeah.
the lousiness of
Well,
a lot of editorial cartoons.
it's funny that you say that. I mean, there are amazing editorial cartoons, cartoonists and cartoons for sure. But the worst of them is pretty ripe for parody. My first ever cartoon that I had published actually was a parody of a editorial cartoon. I was in Boston at the time, with this comedy crowd, which, a lot of people like Eugene Merman, who went on to great things, a bunch of people that are writing for late night shows right now. Brendan Small, who's done a bunch of animation stuff. Anyway, all these people were in the crowd, and they launched this newspaper called The Weekly Week, which was, I think the tagline was America's only redundant news source for news. And they were basically doing sort of an Onion type thing, but a little bit wackier and weirder. And so they asked me to do like a political cartoon that made no sense, and that would be the joke. So, I did this very elaborate pen and ink drawing of different things, and I had like, how like bad editorial cartoons will do like banners around it. It'll be like justice, whatever, big oil. And so I did all this stuff, and then I think we came up with a caption that just made no sense. And that was the joke, that we were going to do that every week. It's an easy target, bad editorial cartoons. So are bad New Yorker cartoons, though, for that matter. I know there's websites out there that do that.
Well,
Also funny.
there's a website. I don't know if they are still going, but I think it was connected to the caption contests, and it said that any New Yorker cartoon could have the tagline, what was it? Look at this fucking asshole.
I've heard of several of those where you take any caption and put it on a any drawing, and they do sort of work.
Well,
I think
what do you
that
think
stuff's funny.
about the caption contest, which is they originally were just running it once a year, but then I guess it became so popular that they run it every week.
Yeah, they've been doing it for probably a longer time than I even realized. But I have very weak feelings about it. Some cartoonists really dislike the idea of it. They think it's sort of demeaning to our art form, in the sense that, they would never do that with an article or a poem. Have the readers write in the last line, which I guess is a fair point. I think it's good in that it does make some people think a little bit longer about what we actually do. What I thought it would make people realize that it's a little harder than they thought, but I'm not sure that it's actually doing that. I think it's actually making people think it's easier, because I've never, well, that's not true, but I rarely meet somebody who's entered the caption contest and didn't think their caption was better than anything ever, any of the three finalists. They're always like, "Oh, this was my caption. Shouldn't that have won it?" And it's never should have won it. It's usually bad. But people get like a, I mean, it's the same thing when you start cartooning, every idea you have is great. And it's not until you've done a couple thousand that you realize, oh, yeah, those early ones were pretty horrible. So I guess it's not doing that. It's not making people think what we do is hard. In some cases, there have been some people who said, like, yeah, I have a hard time with that, or I've done it and I never come up with a good one. But most people are not that savvy. And as far as from a cartoonist perspective, the tricky part is that more often than not, you will pitch a cartoon in your normal batch that, has a drawing and has a caption, and Bob will tell you, okay, we're going to buy this cartoon for the caption contest, which means they're going to take your caption off of it and let, you know, the readers come up with a better one.
Right.
And so that doesn't feel great to me personally. Some guys have no problem with it. I mean, I've done three of them, I guess. And then after that, I was sort of like, I don't want to be doing that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not in the running for those spots anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time I did it, it was really early on, and I was just curious how many came in. And I asked the cartoon editor assistants just if he could put them on a disc at that point. And it was like 9,000 captions came in for mine. They have a computer program that selects similar captions, and like 40-something people had the same exact caption as me, which I don't know if that's good news or bad news. Uh-huh. I guess it makes sense because I drew the drawing to support that caption. So if people came up with that caption, I guess I did the drawing right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also sort of, it makes you feel a little less special. And also, you know, I thought if I came up with that caption originally and they liked it, they should have just taken the cartoon instead of make it a caption contest.
Right.
In order for, you know, Tom Smith from Toledo to write my caption.
Right. I will admit to having entered a couple times and of course never won. And, sometimes I think that the times I have entered, I was not, committed to my caption being the best one possible. Although sometimes I think mine.
Yeah. So you're the rare, you're the rare,
a little bit better.
Yeah. You're the rare person that has some critical viewpoint on their own work.
We're probably about at the nearing the end of our time. I guess the final question I would ask is if there were a young person who was interested in cartooning and was thinking about, you know, should I pursue this and could I get my stuff in the New Yorker, what advice would you have for that person?
Well, Bob Mankoff has made it a lot easier to get in the door at the New Yorker than it has been traditionally. I think part of that, I mean, I know part of that is because he doesn't want the art form to die off, honestly, 20 years ago, it was probably in danger of that. Now there's a lot of young cartoonists, you know, several in their 20s, who, you know, have just come in the door and met with Bob. So you can call up the New Yorker and you can come in on a Tuesday and show your cartoons to Bob Mankoff.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were young and you wanted to do it, I would suggest that you do that. But you have to know what you're getting into. You have to be able to do 10 ideas a week, every week, and you have to keep doing that for months and months and months, maybe a full year. If you haven't sold in a full year, you're probably not going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I mean, it used to be common for people to submit for 11 years and not sell one, and then they finally do. But now I think Bob will try to encourage you early on if you've got something that he likes, so you'll try to buy him. But a lot of people can't commit to that, and they think they don't need to. They think, oh, this one idea is really good. But Bob doesn't need one idea. He needs cartoonists who can be career cartoonists for him.
Right.
So if you're not doing 10 a week, every week, it's harsh, but don't bother,
because mm-hmm.
there's, you know, 200, 300 people that are doing that, and they're all good. Don't look at the cartoons in the magazine and say, oh, my one cartoon is better than this one cartoon. It's not about that. So while you're doing that, while you're submitting these cartoons, start a webcomic with your rejected stuff, or turning, you know, those rejected single panels into a strip, which is not that difficult to do. So you're doing the best of both. You're trying to get in at the top of the print world, at least for single panel cartoons, which is still the New Yorker, and you're building a web audience. And so you'll have, you know, do that for 10 years, you'll get a bunch of cartoons in the New Yorker, and you'll have a bunch of web fans so that you can sell your own books to them. You can sell t-shirts, and maybe through Patreon or some other service, you can actually get monthly payments
mm-hmm.
to make it work. But mainly you just have to do a lot of work. People don't realize how much time it takes to come up with ideas, and then how much time it takes to do the drawing. It's like children's books, I think. It seems like something that'd be, oh, that would be fun and easy and nice. And it is. It beats real work for sure, but it is, most of it, 90% of it is, it feels like work.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun work, but it still works. So I guess that's what I would say.
Okay, well, hopefully that wasn't too discouraging for any young cartoonist. So
If it is, if it's too, if that's too discouraging, then those people need to be discouraged.
yeah, it
I'm sorry,
certainly
but come
seems.
on. Give my, career and my field a little respect. As much respect as you would ex, you know, give to something else. You gotta do the work. And the work of ideas is the more important part. Most people think, oh, it's fun to draw and doodle, and that's just the end zone dance, really, of coming up with a cartoon idea. Most of it is the writing, coming up with the ideas. Work harder, kids.
Okay, well maybe someone out there is listening to this and will be inspired to put in the work.
Yeah, it only needs to be a few.
Matthew Duffy, thank you so much. The book again, holding up to the camera once more. Hand-drawn jokes are smart, attractive people. It'll be a link below where you can purchase this book on Amazon or wherever fine books are sold. Matthew, thank you so much for coming on Blogging Heads.
Thank you very much. I had a great time. Thanks.
Okay, bye.